Thank you so much. The next section is about masks, and I appreciate that we have our students in grade 4 to 12 required to wear masks indoors. Presumably they get a break from the masks outdoors, and I was wondering if the day will be structured to have regular breaks so that they are outdoors maybe more frequently than they would be, or if that will create more traffic throughout the school, which we want to avoid. And the second part of that question, for students that aren't able to wear masks, perhaps for medical reasons, would a face shield that we're providing to staff be worthwhile? I know that they technically serve different purposes, but if we have any information on that, that would be wonderful.
Associate Director?
Thank you, and through the chair, I'll begin, and then I will ask Sharon to add, particularly on the mask. But in terms of the first part of the question, each one of our schools is being asked to establish very specific routines, keeping class cohorts together indoors and outdoors, and to look at staggering their routines so that we minimize any type of indirect contact out in hallways and certainly out in the schoolyard. And so in terms of the frequency would be maintained by the schedule within the school and obviously at the discretion of the classroom teacher if they wanted to bring a class outdoors more. They always have the option of being able to do that. But I'll ask Superintendent Stefanian to comment on the question about the masks and shields.
So thank you for the question, and through the chair, as you've highlighted, there will be opportunity for families under particular circumstances to look for exceptions to wearing masks for children in grade 4 to grade 12. And part of what we're working through right now is what that process will look like. Certainly, we do have accommodation processes already in place, and so wanting to maintain as much consistency as we can with those approaches to keep it easier for families is at the center of the work that we're looking at. With respect to the questions around masks versus shields, as the trustees said, they do perform different functions. So it's a tough question to answer because it really is thinking about source control and whether or not a mask would provide, a shield would provide the same level of source control as we would see in a mask situation. I also would suggest that it wouldn't be a one-size-fits-all response in terms of the importance of the conversation with the family around why they are seeking the exemption for the child, because it may be a situation where whether a child is wearing a mask or a child is wearing a face shield, there may be similar types of concerns regardless of what it is that they're wearing. And so those conversations are extremely important with families for us to be able to understand the reason and the rationale why. We'll also share with trustees that we do recognize that there will be students who are not wearing masks, and part of the work that we are engaging in as part of our early lessons and learning with students is around normalizing that some students will wear masks and some students won't wear masks, and that's okay. Certainly, we would like as many students as we can to wear masks, but we do honor and recognize that there are legitimate reasons why some would be unable to. So back to the piece around the face shield, it does perform a different function, and I think we would need to look at that on a case-by-case basis in terms of why a student was unable to wear a mask. I think the other thing that I should mention is that face shields are considerably more expensive than masks just from a budget perspective.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. With regards to cohorting, I know we've talked about this before. My one question, I'll bring it up again. If we're doing the elementary reorganization by August 31st, what is the process going to be for parents who maybe need to make a request due to specific needs, whether their family is working together outside of school for after-school care or whether their child would have major anxiety if they weren't in a cohort with someone that they can also play with outside of school? Will we have a process in place for that?
So I'll go to Associate Director Sovereign, and then if that needs to go to Sharon, please redirect.
Thank you, and through the chair, in terms of cohorting, so we would only be cohorting at this time for secondary school students because they were in adaptive mode or scenario B for secondary schools. Elementary is conventional; everyone's back. While behind the scenes, we will be doing the cohorting just to ensure that since we're at it, we will add the cohorts for transportation purposes to elementary. That is really a behind the scenes and just in case we need to move into the adaptive mode. So if anything, it gives us a lot more time in elementary to understand if there are any nuances with the cohorts, but the cohorts would only apply to secondary school students at this time. When secondary school students have the information about their cohorts, just like any time, if there are significant issues, then they should be raised through the school principal and if need be through the superintendent.
Thank you. I just need to follow up on this. So we may not be calling it cohorting, but in elementary schools, we will be putting students into a class, and that class will be isolated from other classes, and that would be used for contact tracing if needed. We're also trying to minimize the number of teachers that come into contact with that class. So it is, we're treating it like a cohort. We're just maybe not going to call it that. So I guess parents would be seeking to reach out to their principal and, if necessary, the superintendent if they had a specific request for their student to be in the same class as another student for whatever reason.
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair. And thank you for the question and for the clarification, Trustee Danko. We do consider class assignments in elementary to be the cohort. However, as we do in any given year, do class assignments, schools have a process where they work with teachers, work with parents in order to find, what they would consider to be the best balance in terms of each one of their classes. It would be really no different this time around other than the challenge of time being the reorganization would actually occur before school starts. But again, if there were exceptional circumstances, then the same process would take place through the school principal first in terms of looking at those good placements.
Thank you. And just in terms of timelines then, would the school principal be available before August 31st, or because you're suggesting that that will all be established by August 31st?
Thank you. Through the chair, the timelines in terms of the reorganization are still being finalized. So what you see in the report is in and around August 31st. That may be slightly before, it may be slightly afterwards. And each school will vary slightly. The data that we gather from families between the 17th and the 21st will largely determine to the extent to which classrooms in any particular school do need to be reorganized. So not trying to provide, you know, a vague answer, but it really does depend on a number of pieces right now. And always, if there's a question or a concern, families are welcome to, you know, contact the school and leave a message for the principal with their specific concerns.
Thank you. Also looking at how we're establishing classes, and we are establishing a remote school so that we'll have separate classes. Can we maximize the class size for remote learning classes and minimize the in-person class sizes, recognizing that there may be shifts throughout the year back and forth at the dates that you described, but can we still meet our class average requirements and meet the ministry requirements by minimizing the in-person class sizes?
Sorry, Associate Director Sovereign.
Thank you. And again, I'll begin, and then perhaps I'll ask Stacey to add to it. But again, it will largely depend on the response that we receive between the 17th and the 21st in terms of the remote learning. And then how the remote school will be organized and what that means at each one of our individual schools. So, again, it will depend quite a bit in terms of the in terms of the response that we get on that. So it may be a bit premature to be able to answer a question, you know, will we be able to adjust you know, and meet our class cap sizes and our average class sizes based on this type of early reorganization. If I got your question correct, Trustee Danko.
Thank you. I hope we can. I know there'll be further discussion after this section on class sizes. So that's fine. Thank you. On ventilation, I know we talked about this previously and it came up in the delegation. We're doing inspections. Can we set aside or do we have funds that we can allocate to purchase air exchangers, whether they're window-based fan units that just help facilitate increased air exchange with the outside air, or HEPA filters for classrooms? Do we have the ability to do that for this startup?
Associate Director?
Thank you, and through the chair. And this question, I will ask Stacey to provide an answer to.
Thank you, and through the chair. At this time, that isn't something that we were contemplating. So it would be an additional cost for sure. In talking to facility staff, the concern about the window units is that whoever's sitting next to the window unit, whether it's a hot day and we're bringing in the hot air, or whether it's the winter and we're bringing in the cold air, it's really hard to regulate the temperature in the classroom with the window units. So, again, it's not a necessity under the requirements of the ministry. We are following all of the requirements. We have five companies in right now doing all of the inspections. If there are anything, and we do inspections regularly anyways, but this, we just wanted to do, take some extra care and have a third party review them as well. We will be doing the regular maintenance. We will be changing all the filters, but at this time we aren't looking at any additional units in classrooms.
Thank you. I hope that still might be an option going forward if a need arises, and I'm certain if you brought it back to trustees, we would likely support it. I won't speak for everyone, but I would. In terms of the outbreak protocol, do we have a timeline for that? I know we're asking parents, and they're starting to panic right now. We're asking parents to make a decision about whether to send their child back to in-person school. I hope this report and the details in it really help people start to work towards their decision, or to keep their child home and do remote learning. But the outbreak protocol, I think, is going to be an important deciding factor for parents. So in terms of timelines, when do we expect this to be available? Will there be an opportunity for feedback, or will that just be through public health and the ministry? And will parents have this before August 17th, before they have to make a decision to keep their child home or to send them into school?
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair. And I will begin just by saying that all the information that we have available to us in a format that we feel is informative, we are making available through these reports, through our other communication channels, and our commitment remains that we know that the outbreak protocol is a very significant piece of information, and so we won't wait for a communication cycle to make that available. We will have that out as soon as we have it finalized. In terms of the timing of the finalization of that, I'll ask Superintendent Stefanian, who again has been working really closely with public health on this, to give us an update.
So thank you for the question. So through the chair, as we spoke about a little bit earlier this evening, we know that the Ministry of Education and Ontario Public Health or the Ministry of Health are working on a draft document for school boards and public health units in terms of how to approach any outbreak or essentially the outbreak protocol. And I believe our director may have information from code that they have shared. What I will share with you locally, however, is that we have already met, and I say we in terms of being the four school boards in Hamilton, so ourselves, our co-terminus boards, French Catholic and French Public boards have already met with public health to talk about some of the broad stroke parameters with respect to what we will be including in our outbreak protocol. We are looking for consistency across the four school boards within the community, again, to make things simpler and easier for families. We recognize that a large extent of the work connected to outbreak will be driven by the work that public health needs to undertake and how we support that work. So, for example, very concretely, if there is a individual within one of our schools who tests positive for COVID, public health has a turnaround time of 24 hours in which they reach out to individuals who need to be tested. So we've already begun to have conversations, and we've already drafted how we will respond and how we will support, but we absolutely need the guidance document from the province in order to inform what the final document will look like once we have that. As I said, we have a number of much of the local thinking is in draft, but we're awaiting that final document. And I don't know if our director has anything further, because I know this has been an item that code has been waiting for as well.
Thank you, Sharon. What I'll add is we've asked on weekly teleconferences with the ministry, who's also working with COVID Command Table and Ontario Public Health, that there would be some templates provided as guidelines to help with local public health units around the breakout management. We've asked for them last week again when we can be expecting them, and we were told they should be expecting soon, because this is an area across the province that the ministry has said that they want consistency in terms of breakout management. We have another teleconference this Thursday, and I know it's on code's list of items that we're saying are very urgent, so parents can make informed decisions.
Thank you for that. And related to that, I asked previously about what would a triggering event look like? What would trigger a shift from the conventional to an alternative delivery model? Would it be a school outbreak, a community caseload increase, or other? And in the Sick Kids report on July 27th, they indicated this is critical for a safe back-to-school plan. Would that be part of the outbreak protocol, or is that something that gets established separately?
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair,
John,
I'm actually going to pass.
Left.
I will pass it to Superintendent Stefanian, but perhaps wait for Trustee Danko to reemerge.
Okay. Well, in that case, I think I'm. Why don't you answer that for everyone, and then we'll keep moving on.
Okay, so through the chair, in our conversations that we've had with public health and the four boards together, we have already had a conversation around the question that Trustee Danko asked in terms of, first off, what would define an outbreak, because what we have seen emerge in other sectors is the definition of what an outbreak is for COVID is different from what an outbreak is for other types of illnesses. So, again, that will be informed by what we see come forward from the province in terms of definition for outbreak. And then in terms of how we respond to an outbreak and whether or not that will trigger, it certainly will trigger contact tracing and in all likelihood will trigger some level of isolation for those who were exposed. But could it trigger something greater than that? So if we are talking about an outbreak, and again, there's very specific criteria that would be used to identify an outbreak, would we then be potentially looking at closure of a school or shifting to another model? So while we've had those conversations and what that could look like locally, we do anticipate that that will be informed by what we see coming provincially. And so once we have that document, we'll look at how that would actually play out locally within our school community.
Thank you. And we'll make note of this to pass on to Trustee Danko as well. I'm just hearing she's having a little bit of difficulty getting back on. So with that, I'm going to keep moving along. Trustee Deese?
Thank you.
Trustee Deese? Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. So, you know, like I said, trustees, I just want to recognize, I know this has been an incredible amount of work for staff, and I know you've looked at every option through every angle, through every lens. So just respecting the amount of work that you've done. I have a couple of questions for clarity. And so the first one is in regards to elementary, when you're saying that that for those that choose at-home learning, that they can only come back on specific dates, so you mentioned that this was a change, because I know previously we've said that it was 5 days notice. So you had mentioned that this was a ministry guideline. So is this ministry mandated? Or is this our decision, just to clarify?
Associate Director?
Thank you, and through the chair. So let me preface this by saying that all of the ministry directions that have been provided have come through the guidelines documents, have involved our review by the ministry in terms of our plans, and so there is there are very few elements of those guidelines that are mandated. In terms of these reentry points, they're not mandated by the ministry, but they're certainly advised in the guidelines. And upon our own review, in terms of setting up the remote school with class sizes that are still within the provisions of both the collective agreement and also in terms of the average class size and the class size caps, it does require us to look at, do we have space within the remaining in-school classes? Because as we reorganize those classrooms with the same amount of staff, those in-person classrooms are still going to have those maximum numbers. And in addition, those in-person classes, as we said earlier, while there's no requirement to have a 2 meter distance in a conventional mode, we are still trying to maximize the distancing within those classrooms. And so, if we didn't provide these different windows in time, as recommended by the ministry, then it would be very unmanageable in terms of having students shift from remote back into in-person and ensuring that we meet all of these requirements and some of the distancing requirements. So short answer is it's not mandated. It is highly recommended. And in our review and in our follow-up meeting with the ministry, they again reemphasized having just a few critical points in time in the year where students can move back from remote into the in-person, of course, barring some extraordinary circumstance.
Okay, thank you. The other question I have is, again, for clarification around transportation. I know we were asking parents if they could take their children to and or drop them off at the school, but recognizing there are parents in the rural areas that have to drive, you know, half an hour each way, so you're looking at 2 hours out of their morning if they have to drop their children off and bring them back. So there is no, I'm assuming there's no guidelines around this or no, we're just asking them, parents, that if you can, but the expectation or is that if they can't, then they continue to take transportation. Is that correct? Associate Director?
Thank you, and through the chair, yes, the both in the revised guidelines and in the previous guidelines, the strong recommendation is that understanding that there are limitations, both in terms of spacing on buses, as well as the number of drivers, transportation should be continue to be reserved for those who would not otherwise be able to go to and from school. And that's why it was placed in both sets of guidelines, that recommendation. That said, we continue through transportation services to assume that, students who are eligible, will ride the bus. And that's why Transportation Services is reaching out to families of eligible riders to hear from them directly if they are going to use the service or if they're not, so they can plan accordingly, essentially with a scarcer resource. Stacey, I don't know if there's anything else you want to add to that.
No, I don't think that anybody who is eligible for transportation, we will be doing everything we can to accommodate them for transportation.
Okay, thank you. The other question in regards to transportation is masks, and I believe Trustee Bingham asked it, but I'm not sure if I heard an answer. Is it going to be up to the bus drivers, I'm assuming, to supervise that the kids keep their masks on in the bus at all times? Associate Director?
Thanks. I'm going to ask Stacey again to comment on this one.
Thank you. And through the chair, that is our assumption right now, is that there will not be any additional funding to support somebody else riding the bus and supervising. So just like they are responsible for behaviors on the bus. And I guess, as we remember, buses are an extension of the classroom. So if the driver does have concerns, then they would follow up with the schools after the fact. So to a certain extent, yes, but then they can track and record, and we'll have alternate measures to be able to deal with those students appropriately.
Okay, and with that, I'm assuming that since we're tracking it and if the bus driver is letting the school know if there's students that continually refuse to wear their masks or pulling them off or whatever, then we'll address it at that time or perhaps look at other alternate measures, or is that the idea?
Yeah, similarly to all issues that happen on the bus, we would deal with that. The company would work with the schools and determine the appropriate measure. That's correct.
Okay. And I think that's it for – oh, the other question I had was in regards to hand sanitizer. So I noticed that we said that students can bring their own hand sanitizer up to 16 mil, I believe. Now, hand sanitizer is poisonous, so I'm just wondering, in regards to that, students bringing their own, just some concerns around it. So I'm just wondering if there's going to be any monitoring of that, or where we have the hand sanitizer set out, if there'll be any monitoring around that. Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the Chair. Perhaps I'll begin by asking Superintendent Stefanian to comment on that, and then I may ask if the superintendents working on our elementary reentry have any comments as well. But we'll begin with Superintendent Stefanian.
Thank you. So through the Chair, a fundamental part of planning for September is going to be the communication that we have with families. And so we are anticipating that we will have some families who ask about sending their children to school with hand sanitizer. And so the guideline that's included in the report tonight allows us to remain compliant with the fire code in terms of the amount of flammables that would be in a classroom. However, we are not asking that families send their children with hand sanitizer. We will be providing hand sanitizer in all of our classroom spaces, including those spaces that have sinks. So some classrooms will have both hand sanitizer as well as sinks. In addition to that, we will be having hand sanitizer available at all of the entrances to our schools. Again, we're currently working with the fire department around how to do that in a way that keeps us compliant with the fire code. But again, if a family chooses to send their child, that's a guideline that we provide that is consistent with what we have provided for families in the past during cold and flu season. So there is no change in that regard. But it certainly is not an expectation that families are sending their children with hand sanitizer.
And I'm also just wondering in our signage, just awareness around, around hand sanitizer being poisonous. Is that something that could be included in our signage?
So thank you. And through the Chair, and I apologize, I missed that part of the trustee's question. When hand sanitizer is being used in a classroom, the expectation and the guidelines that we provide are that the sanitizer is being used under supervision by staff for younger children for the reason that the trustee has identified. And we certainly can look at ensuring that messaging around the sanitizer is clear. So thank you for that.
Wonderful. Thank you. And then just I think I have one other point of clarification. That was in regards to in the same cohort in secondary schools, because I have the question today. So I believe that we are trying to keep family members in the same cohort. Is that correct? Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the Chair, that is correct.
Penny, Trustee Dee. Perfect. Thank you. Now, my question is around, and again, I recognize that you put a lot of research and time into determining the best models for secondary. I am getting a lot of feedback from parents, and most of them are asking why we are not doing the quadmester model. And I know I went on the ministry guidelines, and it talks about two models on there. My computer kicked off. It talked about the quadmester model there was two models. They didn't mention rotational, so I'm assuming the second one they're talking about is the study hall model. So is the study hall model the same as the rotational model? Associate Director.
Thank you very much. I'm through the chair. So let me begin by saying that I want to thank Superintendents Denemy and Dunlop for leading this work, again, with a number of principals and vice principals our colleagues from OSSTF local, exploring all of the different models. And so when we presented our model to the ministry on July the 27th, they had a number of questions around the model, and the feedback we received both on the 27th and in our subsequent very specific follow-up with them on our secondary model after we read that same document that you are referring to, Trustee Beath, on the 30th of July, their response was similar, that their rotational model actually satisfies all of the criteria laid out in the ministry guidelines and really exceeds the criteria around safety and the indirect contacts. Having seen the document on the 30th of July and having worked with a variety of different models, we were certainly prepared to revisit the quadmester model, even though the quadmester model was one that we had looked at previously and in our discussions with Hamilton Public Health. Their advice was that it didn't adhere to the single cohort and indirect contacts. And so that was one of the main reasons why we continued with the rotational model, in addition to the other reasons that we talked about before. So in our follow-up discussion with the ministry representatives on the 4th of August, they provided us with an example of how a quadmester versus our rotational model might impact indirect contacts. And so if we simply took our students' timetables and choices of courses in our average size secondary school and allowed students to attend in a quadmester model, which means two courses, which means two different cohorts of students, the number of indirect contacts that any given student would have in our scenario would be well over the 100 limit that's in that guideline.
Join.
By 2 to 3 times more. So when we inquired how it could be possible to have a quadmester program, they did provide two very significant points. The first is that course selection would have to be limited. And so one of our guiding principles being not disrupting our regular school routines, and for secondary, that means the courses that our students have already selected and in their different pathways, that would have to be redone. And it would have to be restricted in order to achieve the indirect number of contacts over the two cohorts. The second piece that they also illustrated would need to occur is that students taking courses in grade 11 and 12 would very likely, from what they've seen in quadmaster models from others, need to rely on e-learning very heavily, because there isn't the ability to limit as significantly the number of courses in grade 11 and 12 than you can in grades 9 and 10. So to be absolutely transparent and fair, the ministry did put out these criteria and suggestions in their first set of guidelines, which is why we began to explore them with our ad hoc committees, with our guiding principles, and that's why we came up with the rotational model. So again, we were very prepared to move to a quad model, but it wasn't until we had that meeting where they suggested that, in fact, we should absolutely stay with the model that we have. It meets all the criteria. It exceeds the safety requirements. It's easy to move in and out of if need be. And even if the class, if the cohort size were to increase as they anticipate would be the next step, still in the adaptive mode, but increase the cohort size, the model that we've gone with is one that would, again, allow for the indirect number of contacts to remain the same. We've learned subsequently that a number of other school boards, large school boards, have also shifted to the rotational model. So I hope that helps answer your question. I will say that it is quite complex and has taken an awful lot of time with some very, very dedicated people to work through all of the different possible scenarios and nuances, and then to make it fit within a four-period school timetable and a five-period school timetable. So it's a great question, and as I said, quite a complex undertaking.
Thank you, and it does. I mean, like I said, obviously, you know, you've looked at this, and a lot of expertise has gone into this. So, but I am getting, and I'm sure other trustees are getting some pushback on that quadmaster model. So, it might be helpful if we had a little bit of a, you know, quick comparison on the two, that we could, you know, that we could show some of the differences that you've talked about. I just want to make sure that with those two models, I think because my fear is that with different schools adopting different models, what the learning outcomes will be, and whether, you know, obviously we don't want our students to be at a disadvantage, especially with, you know, with applying to secondary and everything. So is that something that we're going to be monitoring, comparing how our students are doing versus students in different models?
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair, appreciate the question. Will we be monitoring? Absolutely, we will be monitoring as we normally would, and probably with certainly a lot more vigilance this year in terms of are there things that are not working that we need to make adjustments to in terms of the model that we have implemented. In terms of comparing it to others, that would be more long-term, and part of our conversations with other boards, obviously. What I will say to the to your comment, Trustee Deese, around ensuring success for all of our students. That certainly was and is always front and center of our consideration. So on top of course, the safety concerns is the ability to continue with those established routines. And so we know that students undertaking four courses over the length of an entire semester has shown to be more effective than condensing the content in a shorter period of time, particularly for some students who may miss due to illness or other reasons. The more you condense the period in which the curriculum is covered, the greater the impact is in terms of any time missed. So being able to keep those four courses available for an entire semester was really key for us. There's also a real familiarity with doing four courses over the course of, over the stretch of the semester. This rotational model maintains that and maintains the integrity of the four courses, contact with teachers in all four courses, there isn't an experience, to our knowledge, in our board at least, of shifting to far more condensed two courses within that time period. So I do know that we've been in constant conversation with the Coterminous Board as well, perhaps I'll pass it over to the director if he wants to provide an update around some of the conversations we've been having just between our two boards.
So thank you, through the chair. So thank you, Trustee Deep, for your question around quad mestering. I've had a most recent conversation with the Coterminous Board today, but we've been speaking throughout the process because they were exploring quad mestering, and something they put out last week in communication indicated that. But once they understood, speaking to Dave Hansen, the director, who said I could share this, or once they understood the parameters around quad mestering that Peter has outlined in terms of what it means to limit courses and redirect students, they are going to use public health guidance around one cohort only. And as of today, he said I could share a letter went out to their community. They're using a different model, what they're calling a summer school model. Like Peter said, there are pros and cons of a model. The summer school model will be students taking one course at a time. So for 4 weeks, they do one course and a blended approach where they'll have some time face-to-face in the morning and then going home to do independent study and then some synchronous online. The con on that, as Peter has outlined, is that students who need time to demonstrate their learning over a four-week time period, it's a lot of content to absorb. And if a student does get sick or ill or something happens and misses a week in the time period of four, that is 25% of the course. So they have shifted their model, and in conversations we've had, I know York Region has shifted their model from quad mestering once they understood the parameters around that to a rotational model like ours. And in most recent conversations with Halton District School Board, they initially had thought of a quad mestering, but are now leaning towards a rotational model as ours after they understood what the parameters were around direct and indirect contacts and that and what it meant. So that's just an update from some of the local boards and most recently from our Coterminous Board that I had conversations with today.
I appreciate the extra clarity on this, and I do see, I think from you mentioned about they're familiar with it and that they continue to have the four teachers that they're engaged with
And as we know, and I've seen, you know, students often have favorite courses that keep them engaged, and the less courses that they have, you know, the better chance of them potentially being disengaged. So thank you. Thank you for that clarity. And then my other question is supervision. So there are going to be, as we know, families that where there'll be no supervision when these high school students are home. So if there is a problem, I guess, one in noticing that the students are perhaps falling behind online or not engaging in line, do we have an option for students that perhaps need supervision? I know at one time we talked about reaching out to partners or whether they could go, like I said, to the Y or library or something like that. Is there going to be opportunities, because there are going to be instances where parents may not want their children home alone?
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair, and appreciating Trustee Deep's question, and I know you've asked this question at each one of our sessions, and the reply is similar, that you know, now that we have our models more finalized, we're turning our attention to all of the other pieces around how do we support, how do we adjust to some of the what ifs. And so, again, very thankful for the question and the comment, and that we do continue to look at what might be some of those options. We know that they are going to be quite specific to particular families at particular schools, and so we're certainly anticipating some of that and looking at responding. But at this time, we don't have any you know, firm commitments from any one of our partners for the reasons that I've just indicated.
Okay, thank you. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving along now, we'll go to Trustee Galindo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a handful of questions. First, I want to just echo Trustee Begum, Trustee Danko's comments earlier. Thank you to staff. Welcome to the student trustees. I do want to pass through my questions, though, so let me get started. I took a look at the report in front of us today. How frequent will washrooms be cleaned during school hours? I'm not seeing that in the report under enhanced cleaning measures. It addresses other surfaces, but not specifically any expectations for how often our washrooms are going to be cleaned in the classroom.
Associate
in the school.
Director. Associate Director.
Oh, thank you. And through the chair, I'm actually going to pass this over to Associate Director Zucker, who has responsibility for facilities.
Thank you. And I'm just sorry, could you repeat the question again, please?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we currently know what our expectations are for cleaning washrooms daily? Do we want to clean them 2, 3, 4 times? I didn't see that in the report.
Thank you. And through the chair, sorry. The expectations are laid out in the protocol. There will be staff is still working with the unions to make sure that we have it scheduled properly and that we have the appropriate number of staff to be there. Obviously, there will be enhanced, so meaning more than once a day, and then if there are any incidents, that they would be taking care of those as well.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, just because the draft protocol and the document didn't actually address the washroom question, so I appreciate that answer. My next question is with regards to class sizes. Again, clarification questions, just because I know we're hearing a lot of discussions, but for my clarity, as of right now, do we actually have a limit on how many students will be in each classroom? If we do, is it based on the actual capacity of that specific classroom, or are we looking at you know, based on grades, I guess is my question, because I found the report that we're looking at 20 to 23 students per the average, grade 4 and up or something like that, but do we actually have an expectation of actually laying out a limit for how many students we plan on having in the classroom? And I guess that goes hand in hand with the expectation that we are going to have parents who want to send their students back later in the year, and I'm trying to figure out if we have an understanding of what that limit is going to be as of right now.
Associate Director?
Thank you, and through the chair, I'll just begin broadly, and then I will turn it over to the director for further comment, and to the associate director as well. But in terms of secondary schools, adaptive model, we've certainly been given the parameters of cohorts of approximately 15 students, which is what we're adhering to. And as we've indicated in the report at this time, the number of students per class is based on our allocation of staffing. And so we're currently moving forward with those parameters, both for our in-person classes and our remote classes. That being said, and I believe this was connected to a question earlier by, I believe, Trustee Danko, that with our remote classes, not having the requirement of physical distancing, there is the opportunity to maximize the size of those classes, still staying within our required parameters, of course, but there is more flexibility there, which will, potentially impact the size of classes remaining in person. That's all just to reiterate what's already in the report, but I will hand it off to the director, who may have further comments.
Well, thank you, Peter. We've had this discussion at the with the ministry and code, and as Peter identified today, ministry has stated that they are expecting boards to use all their resources as we look at families who choose remote learning. In other words, if X amount of students leave the physical classroom in elementary, we're not expected to leave a classroom at 10 students. So our collective agreement class sizes is what we're funded at. So in kindergarten, I believe it's at 29. It could be as high as 29. In grades 1 to 3, we are staffed and funded at class cap of 20 for 90% of our classes. And 10% of our classes can go as high as 23. And then in grade 4 to 8, I'll ask someone to correct me, but I believe it's around 24.3 or 24.4 as a system average. So once we know the number of parents who are choosing remote, we'll know how many, to start the year off, we'll know how many students will be remaining in the physical classes, and then we'll be asked to reorganize. The HR will be leading with, us through with our unions. So those are the numbers we're working with, and as you heard Peter also indicate, if physical distancing is important for safety reasons, we would still have to meet those parameters, but could fluctuate slightly different from the remote to the physical space. If we were in adaptive, which we're not in elementary, and just to be clear with trustees, if we were in adaptive model opening up on, 15 would be the number just like secondary. But since we're not, we have to use the current, we've been directed to use the current staffing level in our collective agreement because that's what we're being funded at. And if sometime in the middle, sometime, as Stacey said, we can apply for extra funding. However, before we do so, the ministry will be asking us if we've exhausted all of our potential resources, potential being reserves, potential being, setting a a deficit budget of 1%, which boards are allowed to, and redirecting any other staff that are not assigned to classrooms, for example, like program consultants or reading specialists. They would be asking us to look at all those resources when we submit our business case for potentially additional funding. I hope that answers Jesse Galeno's questions in terms of the numbers we're being asked to use at this point in time for elementary.
Trustee Galindo?
That does help answer that question. I appreciate the response. Moving on to my next question, the associate director earlier spoke to there being key points throughout the school year where parents will have the opportunity to switch learning models. So after Thanksgiving, after the December break, after March break, for example, will that process be the same for families who want to switch from in-person learning to remote learning? Because I get the sense that there are numerous families that want to give the first week of school, for example, a try and then make a final decision afterwards. So if I could get clarification on if we're going to ask them to wait until after Thanksgiving to make that decision, or if it's different for those who are going from in-person to remote learning.
Associate Director.
Thank you, and through the chair, thank you for the question. We are looking at that right now because, again, we will be required to maintain our class cap sizes and average class sizes as well, both in the remote learning school as well as all of our other schools. And so it will be a bit challenging to answer the question very early on when we have to adhere to those requirements if someone was moving from in-person to remote. A simpler way of answering that question would be at a later point in time or for a brief period in time if someone, if a student, for instance, was ill or went away and wasn't able to attend in person, we would not shift them over to the remote school. We would have them continue in their regular classroom, much like they would if the remote option wasn't available. But back to your initial question, if there is a desire to move from in-person to remote, we would strongly encourage all families to, make their choice between the 17th and the 21st in terms of for planning purposes, and then if there is an exceptional circumstance where they did want to move either from in-person to remote or the other way around, that we would work through the school superintendent on that.
Just going to jump right in. Thank you for that answer. I appreciate it. Next question. I have a few comments to make around the outbreak protocol, and because we don't have the outbreak protocol set in stone as of right now, one of the challenges that I foresee is the fact that COVID-19 test results can often take several days, if not weeks, to come through. And if that's the case, how do staff differentiate COVID-19 symptoms versus the symptoms of any other cold or flu or any other bacterial virus that's still out there in the community? That's one of my concerns with the outbreak protocol. In the event that students are sent home and are in quarantine for a while, will they automatically transition to remote learning if that's the case? If the whole classroom suddenly has to not come to school for 2 weeks, for example, does that transition to remote learning?
Associate Director, and they'll answer to the best of their ability in terms mm-hmm. of how you would tell between colds and whatnot. But Associate yeah. Director.
Thank you, and through the chair. the first part of your question around determining symptoms and deciphering those, I will ask Superintendent Stefanian to just provide a comment on that, because I know she's worked really closely with our public health colleagues in terms of the screening process, which is quite detailed. But just to end, before I send it over to Superintendent Stefanian for that, to the second part of your question, we do anticipate that there will be times when students will be away from class. It happens all the time. And we do anticipate that it will continue to happen. And it may happen as a result of requiring to be in a